Hey everyone, it's me, Amy Walter. Before we start the conversation, I wanted to let you know that this podcast is brought to you by the Cook Political Report. If you're interested in more of our great content, consider signing up for our free newsletter, In Brief. Look for the link in our show notes. Hey there, and welcome to The Odd Years. I'm Amy Walter. Way back in the late 1990s, Cook Political Report founder Charlie Cook had an idea to rank all 435 congressional districts by their partisanship, that is, whether a district is more Republican or more Democratic. That way, we'd be able to see, at a quick glance, which members of Congress represented districts that were either slightly or strongly partisan. For example, whether a certain Republican representative was in a very solid Republican seat, or one that was only slightly red, or even one that was blue or blue-leaning. Thus was born the Cook PVI, which stands for Partisan Voting Index. And since 1998, we've released a new edition every 2 years. This admittedly very geeky undertaking is also something we get really excited about because it can not only tell us the partisanship of every district, but with more than 25 years of data, we can see how districts have shifted over the years. The person behind the Cook PVI and how it all works is my talented colleague, David Wasserman, our senior editor and elections analyst. I invited him on to explain in his very clear way what the Cook PVI is, how we calculate it, what we learned from it for 2025, and what it may tell us about elections in 2026. Dave and I talked on Wednesday, April 9th. Here's our conversation. Well, hello, Dave Wasserman. How are you?
Hey, doing well. How are you?
I'm a little chilly. This is why April to me can be frustrating. I get way too excited for the onset of summer and then remember that we live in Washington and there's always a week or two of 30 plus degree weather.
It's the great fake out.
It is the great fake out. But we are here to talk about one of our very favorite things, which is the Cook PVI, Partisan Voting Index, which has been around now for more than 25 years. And Dave, you have dug into this data like no one else and understand it like no one else. So for those who are not quite familiar with what it is or why they should care about it, can you just give us an overview?
Sure. Well, Amy, you're the OG PVI person because you were around pretty close to the start of when we started putting these scores together. But the Partisan Voting Index is an attempt to measure the partisan lean of every single district and state against the nation as a whole. And although there are a lot of election results that are important for understanding how a district or state performs, you know, at the state legislative or gubernatorial level or Senate results, only the presidential race allows for total comparability across state lines. And so what we do is we take the two most recent presidential election results and we take a weighted average. And so the most recent race, in this case, 2024, gets three times as much weight as the second most recent race, 2020. And we take a look at what the national two-party share for each party in the popular vote was. And then we measure what it was in each state and district. It sounds simple enough, but actually calculating the results by district involves some intricate math for counties that are split between districts. And so we've partnered with Dave Leap's Atlas of U.S. Elections. And in the past, we partnered with a firm called Polydata. And so we have commissioned the results by district. And essentially, if a seat has performed, let's say, 4 points more favorable to Democrats in the most recent presidential elections compared to the nation as a whole, then it has a score of D plus four. Let's say the national value is right at 50%, but Trump got 55% in a district. on average, it would have a score of R plus 5. So that's more or less how it works. And we've seen a lot of change over the years.
Yeah. And that's what I want to get into. But that is an excellent explainer. And so I think, you know, sometimes folks look at this and hear R plus 5, D plus 16, right? Does this mean that the district is 16 times more Democratic? No, what it means is that if you, as you said, it's a great way to compare all 435 districts against a common result, right, which is the presidential election result. So that if you are looking at a district and deciding, well, is this district actually competitive or not? You've also looked at that and said, yeah, anything that is somewhere between a D plus 5 or an R plus 5 is a competitive seat. In other words, these are districts that went for one presidential candidate or the other, but not overwhelmingly so. So what do we know about those competitive seats? And what about over time? I mean, we know that there are fewer and fewer swing districts. And why is that?
That's right. Well, in the first iteration of the Cook Partisan Voting Index, there were 160 districts out of 435 that were between R plus 5 and D plus 5, which is, I like to think of those as the partisan 40-yard lines on a football field within that range. That's where most of the competitive races take place. And, you know, back in 1997 or 1999, were there competitive races outside that range? Sure. There were a lot of Democrats, and we'll get into this, but there were a lot of Democrats and Republicans who were defying the partisan leans of their districts at the presidential level. But most of the races have always taken place, most of the ones that the parties spend a lot of money on, take place within that D plus 5 to R plus 5 range. And that number, 160 of those seats, that was higher than the number of solidly Republican districts, R plus 5 or more, which was 153, and the number of pretty solidly Democratic districts, which was 122. And over time, a combination of self-sorting, in other words, the tendency of like-minded voters to cluster in certain areas, I would argue the kind of the information, the prevailing informational ecosystem in given regions of the country that kind of push softly committed voters towards the dominant viewpoint wherever they live, and then also redistricting. They've all kind of worked hand in hand to eviscerate the count of swing seats. And in 2019, we saw that hit an all-time low of just 71, which was a 57% decline from the 164 that we had in 1999. And we saw the number of swing seats tick up after 2020 because there were a lot of districts, for example, in Texas or districts in suburbs around the country that became less reliably Republican than they had been. And then redistricting tamped that number back down to 82 as the parties that controlled redistricting drew predominantly safe seats. And in this year's PVI report, we saw the number of swing seats rebound slightly to 87. And most of that change was coming out of the D plus five or more column. And what happened is that Donald Trump made inroads with working class non-white voters. And some of the biggest PVI shifts that we saw were in majority Hispanic and majority non-white urban districts in general. Most of those are safe Democratic seats, but a few of them fell below that D plus five threshold, which resulted in a handful more swing seats. And it's important to note that 87 number, that's still only a fifth of the House.
That's right. So that the actual, you know, number of competitive seats has continued to shrink. But as you said, we are also becoming, in some ways, less geographically polarized, at least when it comes to districts that are overwhelmingly non-white, districts that have a significant minority population. So can you give us some examples of that, places where Trump did considerably better in 2024 than he did in 2020?
For sure. And, you know, when we look at the top 25 moving districts, the top 25 that moved left over the course of the last couple of years and the top 25 that moved right, you know, the district that moved the farthest left only shifted by 4.1 points, but there were 37 congressional districts that moved right by more than 4 points. And it was a story of racial depolarization where Donald Trump was making big strides in places like LA, in New York City, in non-competitive states, non-competitive districts, but some familiar names on that list. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's district actually had the biggest increase in Trump's vote share between 2020 and 2024. Richie Torres's district in the Bronx, similar story. And these districts went from, in AOC's case, D plus 27 to D plus 19. In Torres's case, D plus 35. It used to actually be the most Democratic district in the country, to D plus 27. But there were also places that are minority majority that are getting a little bit close, too close for comfort for Democrats. For example, Vicente Gonzalez's district in Brownsville and McAllen, Texas, went from D plus 9 to even. And now Democrats are having to work really hard to hold on to that seat that they traditionally won by a mile. Or look at some of the districts in South Florida that used to be safe Democratic seats. And in fact, when Governor DeSantis and Republicans adopted a congressional map in 2022, they basically wrote those seats off. Well, now a number of them, including those held by Jared Moskowitz, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, they are becoming, Lois Frankel, they are becoming more evenly divided to the point where maybe in a strong Republican year, those could be in play.
Yeah, and that's what's really fascinating, Dave, because for the last few years, certainly since the era of Trump, what we've been talking about is the movement in these mostly white, college-educated areas in suburban America that shifted pretty dramatically from their Republican moorings, you know, places outside of Phoenix and outside of Atlanta and Philadelphia that had been voting for the John McCains and George Bushes and Mitt Romneys that were starting to vote for Democrats. Now the shift that we've seen in the last two presidential cycles, as you said, it's these working class voters of color. In some places, the Democratic advantage is so large that even pretty significant shifts aren't enough to put it into play. But Texas, Florida are two places that we really wouldn't have been talking about 4-8 years ago, that we're going to see more competitive races.
Well, yeah. And these are seats that just a couple of years ago when Republicans drew them, for example, in South Texas, they didn't really think that Vicente Gonzalez's district would be a strong opportunity. They packed a lot of Democratic voters into that district in Brownsville and McAllen. And yet that seat has migrated from D plus 9 in our last PVI index to even today. And Democrats are having to work harder to hold on to that seat.
And yet it seems as well that the suburban movement away from Republicans has also just kind of hit a plateau. Is that fair to say that all the movement that has happened it's basically done. And there's not many other places that got much better for Democrats.
Well, if you look at the top Democratic trending districts, it includes a number of mid-sized metro areas that are attracting left-leaning professionals that are a bit lower cost of living than some of the big metros. And we're looking at Colorado Springs or Asheville, North Carolina, or Vancouver, Washington. These are some of the districts that are entering the competitive zone from the right. Now, I think the overall takeaway when you size up the PVI data from the last 8 years, or, you know, since Trump came onto the scene as a candidate, Republicans have made a trade. They have traded away support of white college graduates who are numerous in a lot of the swing seats that decide control the House in exchange for greater support among kind of a melting pot of moderate non-white voters who are working class, and they were attracted to Trump's message on the economy, but they are disproportionately concentrated in those heavily urban and less competitive seats. And you know, in a way, it has opened new possibilities for expansion for the Republican Party, but in terms of the distribution of House seats, it's been a bad trade for Republicans, because just 10 years ago, the median congressional district in our index was 3 points to the right of the nation as a whole, R plus three. And in fact, there were 239 districts when Trump first took office that were to the right of the nation as a whole. And that aligned pretty closely with the 241 seats that Republicans came in with in 2017. Today, it's fascinating. Trump actually won the exact same number of congressional districts in 2024 that he did 8 years prior in 2016, even while he flipped the popular vote in his favor. And that, I think, speaks to just how much less skewed the House is towards Republicans than it was in the past. Today, the median district by PVI is just R plus one. It's David Valadao's district in the Central Valley of California. And so Democrats have a much better opportunity to win a majority of seats, thanks to the fact that they now have a more suburban coalition. And a number of the districts that Democrats flipped in 2018, 2 years into Trump's first term, those realignments have proven durable. Places like Sharice David's district in Kansas City, or Minnesota's third district outside of Minneapolis, or New Jersey 11, where Mikey Sherrill is the incumbent. So these are kind of the growing, more entrenched Democratic seats. And there are plenty of marginal Republican districts where Democrats will have an opportunity in 26.
Yeah. And that's the question too, Dave. If we're talking here today in early April, this tariff rollout has been I think the nicest word is not kind to the way the markets have reacted has been not kind. And obviously there are discussions among economists about its impact further into the year, including the probability of a recession going forward. And you have to wonder then, if what we're looking at going into 2026 is a battered economy and possibly recessionary moment, how many of these districts could Democrats put into play? As you said, there aren't that many that are within the competitive range. There are no Republicans who sit in an overwhelmingly Democratic seat. So how far could Democrats really expand this map?
Well, looking at history, you know, in 2019, when we sized up the districts by PVI score, Democrats were able to drive fairly deeply into Republican territory. You know, prior to that 2018 midterm wave, there were seven Democrats in districts between R plus zero and R plus five, and there were two Democrats in districts that were R plus five or more. But in 2019, there were 29 Democrats in districts from R plus zero to R plus five, an additional 10 Democrats from R plus five or more. So the districts that on paper don't look winnable for Democrats today, you know, they could be surprisingly competitive next year, particularly if Trump's approval on handling the economy is even lower than it was 8 years prior. And, you know, the districts that come to mind are places where you had a presidential result last year in the high single digits in Trump's favor, but where Republican incumbents haven't had competitive races before. And I'm thinking of, for example, Rob Whitman's district in Virginia's first congressional district, which was one of the few that saw an increase in Democrats' vote share between 20 and 24, or that Western North Carolina district held by Chuck Edwards, or that Colorado Springs district, or California's 3rd district held by Kevin Kiley. These are places that over the long term are kind of coming into the Democratic coalition, or at least becoming smack dab in that swing zone, but haven't seen competitive races in the last few years.
Right. That's an excellent point. And the other thing that we'll be watching for is whether or not Republicans can do as well, Republican down ballot candidates can do as well in those districts in South Florida and in Texas as Donald Trump did. Talk to us a little bit about, one, the likelihood that those voters who showed up for Trump are going to show up for the Republican House candidate, and two, whether, you know, a really bad economy could turn what were significant inroads by Republicans in these communities, actually turn it around.
Those are great questions. Look, Republicans are facing a litany of midterm problems already, and we're still more than a year and a half away from the midterm elections.
Yeah, we're not even 100 days into the first.
That's right. And that's probably the best thing that can be said for Republicans, is there is time. But look, there are a couple problems that you touched on. First is that fundamentally, Trump's base, they're not reliable turnout voters for anyone other than Trump. And we saw that in 18. We saw that to some extent in 2022 when Republicans, you know, underperformed their expectations. And we saw it in 2024, frankly, when a number of Trump's voters didn't bother voting for Republican candidates down ballot, costing them key Senate races and a handful of House districts. There were 13 districts that voted for Trump, but also voted for a Democrat for Congress. So that's one part of it. And you know, more than other presidents in the past, Trump's appeal is more about him and less about a broader a party that is part of and parcel of a movement. And the second problem is that Trump's inroads, as you alluded to, were based on feeling thermometer voters. People who were fundamentally evaluating their choice based on the economy and inflation and the fact that things cost 20% more than they had 4 years prior when Biden was initially sworn in. And if they're not seeing that golden age that Trump promised in their paycheck or their investments, then they are more likely to hedge and behave in a thermostatic way against Republicans. And although independent voters make up a smaller share of the electorate in midterm years than in presidentials, if they really flip against Republicans in a big way, then that could lead to pretty severe losses.
Yeah. And it's also interesting, Dave, as you pointed out, with those suburban seats that were Republican pre-Trump have now settled pretty solidly into Democratic districts. But you do wonder if some of these, again, heavily Hispanic districts, especially in the South and Southwest, even if there's a recession or the economy does not come back to the golden age, as you said, do you think they don't snap back to being as Democratic, right? Or like, does it leave it then still in a sort of swingy sort of district? In other words, Republicans may not be able to count on these voters in a midterm year, or that they have them firmly in their camp. But also, if you're Democrats expecting these districts to kind of go back to where they were in the pre-Trump era, also seems kind of naive.
That's right. And what happened in 2024 was Trump carried a lot of voters who had long been assumed to be Democrats based on where they lived and their ethnicity and their disdain for Trump, frankly, in 2016 when his rhetoric was more racially polarizing than his message in 20 or 24 was. The danger for all of us now is to assume that they are now firmly in the Trump camp, when in reality, I think these voters are floating between the parties. Many people who, you know, we might have assumed to be Democrats 10 years ago are now truly independents, and are willing to vote for the right kind of Democrat, even if they are Trump curious or voted for Trump in 2024. So there's an open question as to the durability of the shifts that we've seen. But I don't think these districts that have swung massively are going to swing massively back to where they used to be. We could see them stabilize somewhat, or maybe rebound a little bit for Democrats. But my guess is that even if Democrats hold on to them in 2026, they will continue to pose problems down the line.
Right, that they do swing a little bit more. And interestingly enough, they may be more swingy than the sort of suburban swing districts. I guess that's the other side of the coin, Dave. Is it, should Republicans just assume that, as you said, the suburban Kansas City, the suburban Philadelphia, the suburban Atlanta, that those districts, they're not coming back? I do remember talking to Republicans after 2020 or going into 2020, and their assumption was, well, Biden is going to, you know, do so much damage to the economy that those sort of fiscally conservative voters, maybe socially more progressive, fiscally more conservative, are going to come back home to Republicans, maybe not to Trump, but eventually will come back to Republicans. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, when you drill down on what happened at the precinct level in a lot of these more suburban districts, whether it is Hennepin County, Minnesota, or Johnson County, Kansas, or even Fairfax County, Virginia, what's fascinating is that, mm-hmm. yes, Trump held his ground among those white college graduates and the highest income earners in these places, in those highest income precincts. He didn't really gain ground. He didn't really lose ground. But the shifts that we saw were in the more high density areas and precincts that are more diverse. And so there's kind of multiple layers of trends happening within some of these states and districts. And I think it's premature to say that the bottom has stabilized for Republicans in these kinds of places. There still are congressional districts that Republicans narrowly won in 2024 with, you know, a lot of suburban voters, whether it is in Colorado's 8th or in Pennsylvania's 10th district. And those are really going to be the decisive House seats next year.
Right. Dave, you've seen a lot of House races. You have been involved with the PVI for quite some time. Tell us what you have witnessed just in watching House elections over your career, whether it is we've talked a lot about the kinds of districts that are now competitive that might not have been competitive before, but just thinking through how these races and how the battle for control of Congress maybe looks different today than when you first started covering them in 2007.
You know, when we were both paying very close granular attention to the House in 2007, there were still Democrats like Gene Taylor in Mississippi or Ike Skelton in Missouri who were holding on to districts that voted for Republicans by a mile at the presidential level. And the same was true of several Republicans in Democratic-leaning districts. But two things stand out to me about what's happened. The first is the rise in straight ticket voting has really shrunk the trading range of what can be considered competitive. And so, you know, in addition to that R plus five to D plus five range, we're also looking at a hyper competitive range these days where the bulk of close races take place. R plus three to D plus three range. And the number of those seats has declined by an even greater percentage, from 107 of those R plus three to D plus three hyper competitive seats in 99 to 50 seats today. And for the first time in the history of the Cook PVI, there's not a single Republican in a district that's D plus five or more. And there's not a single Democrat in a district that's R plus five or more. In the previous Congress, Jared Golden and Mary Peltola fit that bill, and Anthony D'Esposito and David Valadao fit that bill previously. Now, those districts have either shifted to kind of match where those members are, or two of them got voted out. The other trend that I've observed is a real bifurcation of House seats according to who drew the lines, whether it was a map that was drawn by a Republican legislature and governor, or whether it was a map that was drawn by a court-appointed special master or a nonpartisan or bipartisan commission. And the value of your vote really depends a lot on whether your state has been gerrymandered. And, to some extent, that's always been true. But because of how well sorted out the American electorate has become on the map, even after, the slight depolarization of 2024, it's become easier for the partisans and map makers who are drawing these lines to polarize districts in a way that makes them non-competitive. So those Republican-drawn states, they account for 41% of all House seats, but just 21% of the seats in our R plus five to D plus five range. Whereas those court and commission drawn states, they account also for about two-fifths of all House seats, but 56% of the swing seats. And that's why the control of the House comes down to places like Michigan, Arizona, Pennsylvania, Colorado on a pretty consistent basis.
Right. So for the reformers who argued that either court-drawn or basically non-legislative drawn maps are fairer, they've actually got something to point to, right? That they're actually right about that?
Yes. And that's not to say that, all court or commission-drawn maps are alike. There are some that have split districts in a way that protects incumbents. But also what's interesting is that the states that were drawn by Democrats, including Nevada, Oregon, New Mexico, New York, Democrats did not necessarily draw super safe districts to the extent Republicans did. They tried to spread out their voters in a desperate bid to win enough seats for the House majority. And so far, that gambit has proven somewhat successful. For example, they hold all three seats in New Mexico now, three of the four seats in Nevada, all but one of the seats in Oregon. But a lot of those seats are in kind of that D plus one to D plus four range. And that means that if Republicans have a good year in the future, then they have a chance of putting those seats in their column.
That is an excellent point. This has been a fascinating conversation. I know that if you are a political nerd, you probably have lapped every bit of this up. And I'm hoping that for those of you maybe who don't think of themselves necessarily as political nerds, you were able to take away some really substantive stuff. Because, Dave, I think you do an excellent job of making this approachable. And to helping people who want to understand politics better, who want to understand why members of Congress behave like they do, why they run campaigns like they do. So I thank you for that, and I know that our listeners thank you for that as well.
Well, thank you for the trust you've placed in me and our team in putting together analysis of the PVI over the years. It's something that you and Charlie Cook pioneered in the late 90s. And I also want to give a shout out to our chief operating officer, Allie Flynn, who did just a phenomenal job putting together all of the graphics in the full report year after year. And I highly recommend checking those out.
I do too. Guess what, everybody? You can see all of this at cookpolitical.com. And when you want to see the charts, the graphs, the historical comparisons, all of that for over 25 years worth of data on cookpolitical.com, subscribers get access to such a treasure of information. And Dave, you've put it in a fantastic context. So thanks so much.
All right. Take care.
Thank you so much for listening to The Odd Years. If you liked what you heard or want to make a suggestion, leave us a review or recommend us to a friend. You're our best way to get the word out about what we do. And if you want more from the Cook Political Report, consider becoming a subscriber. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report and is produced by Becca Kaufman.